Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here with another installment of Yahweh's Covenant People, our Saturday night show. And it seems like I'm always on the air, which is a good thing. The spirit of the air is with us, and that's a good thing. That let me tell you, folks, if Bertrand Comparé and Dr. Wesley Swift and Howard B. Rand had the internet to work with, can you imagine? Can you imagine what the airwaves would be filled with? It would just be glorious, absolutely glorious. And but we are following in their footsteps to the best of our ability, and bringing you the Bible. That's what we're doing, folks. We're bringing you the Bible. How are you this evening, Bill?
Oh, just wonderful. And you?
Yeah. Now, tonight's theme is going to be Colossians chapter 2. And I think you had said to me you had a couple of issues that you wanted to bring up regarding Colossians chapter 1, or was that some other book we were discussing? I can't remember now.
I would have to go back and check my notes from last week, but carry anything over in my notes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it must have been. Yeah.
I might just be confused.
Right. Okay, but yeah, we can just proceed into chapter 2 unless there's anything in chapter 1 that you felt we didn't fully discuss. So if it occurs to you, just go ahead and bring it up, okay?
Sure.
I'm going to be reading from the Moffat Bible, and it's been my experience that when trying to read Paul, the King James, just to be blunt, does a lousy job of translating Paul. I mean, it's just obvious to me.
The primary reason why we have Paul bashers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we'll find out exactly why when we get into Colossians 2:14, how badly translated that is. And unfortunately, I've been having printer problems, and it wouldn't print out my multi-translation of Colossians 2:14. And is your split screen working where you're at?
I have like 20 windows open all the time.
Oh, okay.
I understand split screen.
Can you go to biblos.com and dial up Colossians 2:14 so when we get there, we'll have all the different translations available to us? And I was trying to print them out before, for some reason, my printer just won't do it. It's acting up. So, but here, and if you have any problems with that, let me know. It's actually, Pastor Ken Gregg will be joining us, Randy. I'm waiting for him to call in. All right, so here we go. Colossians chapter 2, verse 1. Yes, I want you to understand my deep concern for you, for those at Laodicea, and for all who have never seen my face. And so, obviously, Paul is writing to a bunch of people, most of whom have probably never met him personally. May their hearts be encouraged. May they learn the meaning of love. Very good. May they have all the wealth of conviction that comes from insight. May they learn to know that open secret of God, the Father of Christ, in whom all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge lie hidden. Bill, any comments on these first three verses? Or are you busy with
the book? I'm sorry. Yes, I was distracted
with
Biblos.com. The prior task I was assigned.
You're right. Okay. Yeah.
I have Biblos.com and Colossians 2:14 up.
Okay. Great. Great.
I wish you to know this as great a struggle as I have for you and those in Laodicea.
Yes.
And as many as have not seen my face in the flesh. This shows that Paul. All right. If we see Colossians 4, and I forget, it's towards the end of Colossians 4. Paul says that. In 4:16, he says, and when the letter is read among you, which shows that Paul's epistles were meant to be written to the common people,
right,
not interpreted by some middleman.
Right.
And also that it is read in the assembly of the Laodiceans.
Right.
Or the Laodiceans.
Yes.
The Laodiceans are the seventh church of the message, the seven churches in Revelation.
Yes, okay.
And this makes it evident, first, that Paul's epistles went out to these various assemblies, And the assemblies exchange them, because he's telling the Colossians to make sure that they get to read the epistle he wrote to the Laodiceans,
right,
and vice versa.
Exactly.
And that from Laodicea that you also read.
Yeah, and then all these people are Israelites and no other type of people.
Right. We'll probably discuss that in a week or two again when we get to
Romans
chapter 4.
Okay.
However, this also shows that neither the Laodiceans or the Colossians have yet met Paul.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, in verse 2, in chapter 2 here, it says that they may be encouraged in their hearts, being brought together in love, and to all riches of the certainty of the understanding in the knowledge of the mystery, and I translate that, of the anointed of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the mystery is, you know, Paul's going out to all these various Greek nations, and they have all kinds of crazy ideas where they came from.
Right.
If you read the ancient Greek poetry,
mm-hmm.
Homer, Hesiod, and don't get me wrong, there are many historical clues that indicate where they came from.
Right.
But as far as descending from the union of gods and women and all the stories that we could imagine they made up out of Genesis chapter 6,
mm-hmm.
they made up.
Yes.
And people came to believe that those things, and that's what Paul, that's what he talks about when he talks about pay no mind to vain, not to genealogies, but to vain genealogies.
Yes,
the
right.
The genealogies in their poetry were invented for entertainment, and they were vain.
Yes,
it's
yes.
clear from if anybody has a thorough understanding of the Near East and Greek, ancient Greek writing, it's clear that the Greeks that came from Palestine, from the Hebrews of the Old Testament.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And,
well,
and
yeah,
that's what Paul means here by the knowledge of the mystery of the anointed.
Right, right. Okay, that we are the anointed seed, and
yes.
Being Israel, yes. And all the commentaries I've read about Paul's so-called criticism of genealogies is not, he's not criticizing the fact that we have genealogies and that we should maintain true genealogies. It's that these exiles did not have true genealogies.
Well,
way they could possibly have had true genealogies. They had to make them up.
Right. If you read Hesiod, the example I like to point out most is the Theogony.
Okay.
It's a poem by Hesiod. And all the different Greek tribes are traced to these patriarchs and these women, but they're mythical characters.
Yes.
They're vain genealogies.
Yes, yes.
And the Greeks, it's clear that the pagan Greeks were saying, hey, what about our poetry?
Right.
How could you tell us we came from there?
Yes.
And we got these records over here, and they're vain genealogies.
Right.
And if we take that in a historical context and understand Greek literature, it's clear what he means by vain genealogy.
Yes, yeah, very, very much so. And certainly the entire exile, the entire dispersion of Israel, since they had lost contact with the temple and the genealogies that were kept in the temple and throughout their various migrations, did not keep records of their kings and queens. And in many cases, they didn't have kings and queens. So that the genealogies were very difficult to keep, if at all. Okay. I see Pastor Greg is with us. Are you there, Pastor Greg?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
You know, one thing they had to do with them too is have them pronounce words.
Uh-huh.
To know whether if they couldn't pronounce words. It's like these Edomites today. You know, they can't even speak good English.
That's right.
Most of them.
Exactly. Yeah, so, and we should not, our speech is not strange to one another, but certainly when you hear an Israeli Jew talk, it doesn't sound anything like an Israelite language, certainly not a language that white people speak. Yes. Okay, so we're at up to verse 4. Okay, any more comments from you, Bill, up to verse 4?
No, I'm good up to there, except that, yeah, okay, I'm good.
Yeah, okay, so I'll just, again, this is the Moffat translation, folks, and when I get to verse 14, I'm going to specifically read the King James Version, which is the antinomian's dream, okay? And by antinomian, we mean those who believe or teach that the law has been done away with and no longer applies. Okay,
right,
verse
but that's
four.
Exactly what it is. It's a dream. It's a pipe dream.
That's right. That's right. Verse 4, I say this to prevent you from being deluded by plausible arguments from anybody, for although I am absent in the body, I am with you in spirit, and it is a joy to note your steadiness and the solid front of your faith in Christ. Very good. Very complimentary comments here to the Colossians. How does your translation compare with this?
Well, that I translate that phrase, probable arguments, persuasive speech.
Okay.
However, probable argument, I mean, Little and Scott, the word is pathanologia, and Little and Scott say it's the use of probable arguments as opposed to actual demonstration.
Uh-huh, okay. So, in other words, words, arguments, not facts.
Right, it's what the Jew is best at.
Right, because, yeah, the Jews hate facts.
Absolutely, but,
right.
But they're experts at persuasion
yeah.
through divisive and creative arguments.
Exactly.
That's why they make such good lawyers.
Yeah, and it goes all the way back to Genesis 3:15. Correct, Pastor Greg?
Exactly.
Further back than that.
It goes back to what?
Further back
the Garden of Eden.
Right. Okay, yeah, definitely.
They are the descendants of the
Nakash. Right.
The enchanter.
Yeah, Nakash. And it occurred to me that, because the word naked comes up so much in Genesis 3:15, just as an aside, since you brought up the word Nakash, that's a version. That the root word of naked is Nakash. And there are Jews who actually have surnames like Nachman and versions of Nakash. Yes.
I had my own theory on the word naked, but it's really not related to Nakash, but that's okay. I just had to throw it up since you mentioned it.
Right. Okay.
The Hebrew word neged is the south, and it's the south because it's the desert.
Okay.
And the desert is bare.
Right. Okay. Man, they're full of double meanings here. Okay, let's go to verse 6. Since you have had the Messiah, even Jesus the Lord, brought to you, lead your life in him, fixed and founded in him, confirmed in the faith as you have been taught it, and overflowing with thankfulness to God. Beware of anyone getting hold of you by means of theosophy, which is specious make-believe on the lines of human tradition corresponding to the elemental spirits of the world and not in Christ. Now, isn't he directly attacking here what Jesus Christ calls the traditions of men, namely the traditions of the Pharisees?
Right, and that's what he's attacking all through this chapter, all the way up into the later verses of it.
Yeah.
And we'll see that upon discussing verse 14.
Yeah.
Isn't that what these churches are doing today? It's their own traditions, basically. I mean, they're saying the law's done away with. We don't have to keep any of the feast days. We don't have to keep a Sabbath. We can eat anything we want to do. Love everybody. And I mean, it's their own traditions that they've made up because they sure didn't get it from the Bible.
That's right. That's right. So definitely Paul is criticizing the current traditions of men, that the Judeo-Christian churches are doing exactly what the Pharisees in the time of Yahshua did.
Right.
There's absolutely no doubt about this. They're inventing doctrine and substituting their doctrine in the place of Scripture. And then when we get to verse 14, we will certainly document this in totality. Bill, any comments from you? Like this translation here corresponding to the elemental spirits of the world and not to Christ. It's kind of an unusual translation here.
Well, it's in accordance with the element. The word spirits isn't there.
Okay.
The Greek word just means the basic elements of
something.
And it's watch. I translate verse 8, watch that there be no one captivating you through philosophy.
Uh-huh.
And the Greek word is actually philosophia.
Right,
Above wisdom. And vain deceit.
Yes.
In accordance with the tradition of men.
Yes.
In accordance with the elements of the society.
Ah.
And not in accordance with Christ.
Right.
And that word cosmos, I consistently try to translate society because basically that's what it means.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and it's very obvious. There's numerous passages in Scripture that tell us that we are to hate the world.
A friend of the world is an enemy of Yahweh.
Right, exactly. And the world hates Yahweh, and the world hates Yahshua.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right, so verse 9, it is in Christ that the entire fullness of deity has settled bodily. It is in him that you reach your full life, and he is the head of every angelic ruler and power. In him you have been circumcised with no material circumcision that cuts flesh from the body, but with Christ's own circumcision when you were buried with him in your baptism, and thereby, this is one of Paul's long sentences, and thereby raised with him as you believe in the power of the God who raised him from the dead. Okay, Bill, why don't you comment first? This is verses 9 through 12, and I'll turn it over to Pastor Greg.
Well, verse 9, I translate that, for in him dwells all the fullness of the divinity bodily.
Okay.
The word divinity is Godhead. Paul uses a very similar word and it's only different in its grammatical form. In Romans 1:20, where he says that where he talks about Yahweh and his eternal power and Godhead, and he uses a very similar word as used by Luke in Acts chapter 17, verse 29, where it says, "For as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead,"
mm-hmm,
"or the divinity, the divine power, is like unto gold or silver or stone." And Paul's there talking to the Athenians.
Okay.
Now, in Yahshua Christ dwells all the fullness of Yahweh bodily. That Yahweh said in the Old Testament, "I will walk with them. I will plant my tabernacle,"
mm-hmm,
"amongst them." The tabernacle is the body.
Yes.
And that is who Yahshua Christ was.
Okay.
"And you are complete in him who is the head of all sovereignty and authority."
Okay.
"By whom you were also circumcised with a circumcision not made by hand in the putting off of the body of flesh, but in the circumcision of the anointed." And that is a direct reference to the children of Israel. Paul's telling these people, they're the children of Israel, circumcised not,
mm-hmm,
in the foreskin of their flesh, but in their hearts.
Right, right.
Deuteronomy
10:16. This is so.
"Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart, and be no more stiff-necked."
Right.
Deuteronomy 36.
"Be no more Scythians."
Well, yeah, Scythians.
Okay.
Deuteronomy 36.
Okay.
"And Yahweh thy God will circumcise thine heart." This is in Deuteronomy.
Yes. Sure.
Very early in the Old Testament was this foreseen.
Yes, absolutely.
And these Colossians are Israelites. They're,
yes,
Israelites of the dispersion. They're primarily Dorian Greeks with some of the other tribes of the Greeks amongst them and some Galatians amongst them, because the city Colossae was kind of on a hinterlands between territory that the Dorian Greeks had, territory that the Carian Phoenicians had,
mm-hmm,
and territory that the Galatians occupied, which was known as ancient Phrygia.
Okay.
So we have multiple tribes of Israel most likely inhabiting the city of Colossae.
Okay,
and,
so like
the Carians at the time, the people of Miletus were, even though they descended from the Phoenicians, they were considered more or less Greeks.
Okay. Okay.
Thales was a famous example. Thales, the Greek philosopher.
Ah,
okay. He's known as the first great Greek philosopher. Herodotus calls him a Phoenician by race. He was a Malaysian by citizenship.
Okay.
And he was a Phoenician.
Okay.
And we'll discuss that more tomorrow, I
yes,
hope.
Yes, right, absolutely.
Well, anyway, Paul is making a direct reference, Jeremiah 4:4, "Circumcise yourselves to Yahweh and take away the foreskins of your heart, ye men of Judah." And this is prophesied again and again.
Oh, yeah.
Children of Israel. And Paul's more or less telling these Colossians that that's who they are.
That's right. Absolutely. Pastor Greg, I want to turn your attention to verse 9. It is in Christ's fullness at verse 9 and 10 of deity has settled bodily. And obviously we understand that in Jesus Christ, in Yahshua, Yahweh dwells. And to the whatever extent the human body can, Yahweh can dwell in a human body, he is in Yahshua. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, the completeness that he's talking about here is when we finally come to that it's more important for us to obey Yahweh than man.
Mm-hmm.
That it's more important to deny ourselves and obey him.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's for the fullness that he's talking about. You know, it's like, man, I'm starving to death and you know, I ain't got nothing to eat and it's Sabbath, and it's not going to be over for 4 more hours before I can buy something to eat. You know, well, if it's more important to you to be obedient to him
mm-hmm.
and deny yourself.
Yeah, because in verse 10 it says, it is in him that you reach your full life. Of course, our fullness is dependent upon Yahweh as well, okay? And I think
right.
that's what you're getting at. And he is the head of every angelic ruler and power. Now,
yeah.
doesn't this verify that there are angels and other powers and principalities in the invisible world that the no-Satan people don't believe in?
Right, right. I mean, he said he's put his angels in charge of us.
Yes.
They're all around us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the no-Satan people are absolutely the modern-day Sadducees.
Yes, right, right. And so, you know, the Bible constantly talks about these invisible beings that they're present all around, that they assist us. And even when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, Yahweh sent an angel to minister to him, okay?
Yeah.
So there's
right.
an angel even in the Garden of, is this some human being, some soldier? And, you know, that's why I don't like to always translate the word angel as messenger, because it's not always a messenger. Sometimes these angels are ministers, ministering spirits, okay? And, you know, for our protection, as in Psalm 91. Okay, so that, you know, they're all, Psalm 91 just tells us they're there to help us and minister to us, but if we ignore his angels and don't believe him and pretend that there's no invisible world that Yahweh has created for us to minister to us, well, then guess what? You don't get any help.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right, very good. So where did we leave off here?
Verse 10.
Okay. Oh, this was this long, drawn-out sentence. Here, verse 13. For though you were dead in your trespasses, your flesh uncircumcised, he made you live with Christ. He forgave us all our trespasses. I'm going to stop right there because I want to set this up for verse 14. So, Bill, this sounds all pretty much straightforward Christian theology. You know, we were dead in our trespasses. That means in our sins, okay? And the wages of sin is death. And as long as we keep sinning, we're going to die, right? Paul repeats this in other places. Your flesh uncircumcised, he made you live with Christ. So we have been given a new life. Isn't that what he's telling us?
Absolutely. And transgression, and you being dead in transgressions and in the foreskin of your flesh,
mm-hmm.
well, First, the fact that they're transgressing proves that they're Israel because there's no sin without the law.
Right, right.
Second, the foreskin of their flesh, being dead in it, that they had stopped the circumcision
mm-hmm.
ritual when they left Palestine.
Right, right.
And so
this is a literal statement. Your flesh uncircumcised is a literal reference to circumcision.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
And you he made alive together with him, forgiving all those transgressions, again proves he's only talking to the dispersion of Israel.
Yes, because
when he went to Athens and spoke to the Athenians, he didn't talk to them about sin.
Mm-hmm.
And they're Adamic Japhethites.
Right.
He talked to them about seeking the true
right.
God, who
right.
to them was unknown.
Yes.
But
yes.
but he didn't talk to them about redemption. He didn't talk to them about recovering anything. And
yes, because even though they were white people, they were not Israelites, and they were not
right.
even Shemites.
Right, and that's a big mistake that even many identity people make, is that Israel is not chosen in contradistinction to the other non-white races.
Mm-hmm.
Israel is only, I mean, the people of Israel are represented today by most of the Celtic and Saxon Germanic
right.
people.
Exactly, exactly.
And they are only a small fraction of
yes.
the original white race.
Yes, yeah. And only the covenants were given to the Israelites.
Right.
And not to
and
the not to the Shemites
chosen,
and the not to the Japhethites or to the Hamites.
Right. They're chosen in contradistinction to the other branches of the white race,
right.
which was, in fact, a very large race.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll cover that on the Chris DeGennis show.
Yeah, and we hope that it remains a very large race. Yes. Oh, Pastor Greg, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, Abraham had children by Keturah, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, absolutely.
And Hagar. And then Abraham had brothers and so forth. They had
right.
children.
Nahor.
But it was only through Jacob and his 12 sons.
Right.
So So right. There were still a lot more white people out there. And like I've said in the past, the Ammonites and the Moabites
right.
were white people.
Yeah, and they rebelled against Israel and they became our enemies. Yes. Yes.
But they were never part of the promise anyway.
Right.
And Paul covers that in Galatians 3:16 that even Abraham's other children are
yes.
excluded.
Right, right. Exactly. So we have to understand that the Israelites, we of the Anglo-Saxon Celtic Caucasian race, are a part of the white race, but yet these covenants and this role as the covenant people, the seed of the promise, we're a number one. We are to lead the way in presenting these scriptures to our own race, as Paul is doing here when he's talking to Japhethites and to some extent Hamites, because a lot of these people still dwelling in Africa are white people of Hamitic descent. Okay? And
well,
so,
in Paul's time, yes.
Yes, and yeah, exactly. Yeah, and there weren't that many left of them, but the Hamites had all kinds of problems down there in Egypt and Ethiopia. But nevertheless, the Anglo-Saxon Celtic, call them the Celtic, Celto-Saxon people, are the ones who are supposed to lead the way with the covenant. And in Genesis 6, I believe, Japheth shall dwell in the tents of Shem. In other words, the Shemites will be the leading, brother. Okay.
Right. And even though some of the, some identity people deny it, the Slavs, it can be demonstrated, are to a great extent Japhethites.
Right.
Now, a lot of Eastern Slavs were overrun by Mongols and Turks.
Right.
But there are still a lot of white Slavs in the world.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
In fact, the westernmost Slavs are probably the Czechs.
Mm-hmm.
And the Germans who inhabit the area of Brandenburg near Berlin,
right.
they descended from the Wends. They're not German.
Okay.
They're basically Slavs.
Yeah.
And Slavs found their way into Britain through the slave trade.
Right. So they're definitely our brothers as long as they haven't become Judaized.
Absolutely. But yes. My point is that the Slavs, the Japhethites, definitely dwell amongst us.
That's right. That's right.
And there's very little denying that if you look at early European history.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that because, the tribal designation passes through the father. So if an Israelite man marries a Japhetic woman or a Hamitic woman, their offspring are considered whatever tribe the father is.
Well, absolutely. And there's all kinds of stories about the Scythians as they pass through Media and Persia and being taken as slaves and taking slaves.
Right.
From the Medes and the Persians.
Yes.
And they're Japhethites and Elamite Shemites of the Persians.
Right. Okay.
Pastor
Greg.
Other branches of the white race,
yes.
but they're not Israelites.
Right. Okay. Pastor Greg?
Well, it's like I said before, when they asked Joshua, why are you speaking in parables? He said, lest they understand and be saved.
Yes.
I mean, it's not for everybody. I don't care if they are white.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then, two, like something you just touched on there now, if I'm an Israelite and marry a woman that's pure.
Japheth, let's say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then her and her children are covered through me.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's how the descent of the tribes takes place. But you can't marry a non-white woman and say the same thing. That's forbidden.
Right.
That's absolutely forbidden.
Right, because that makes a broken cistern.
That's right. That's right. Because the seed line, here's that seed line of such great importance. If the seed line is broken, so are the covenants.
Yeah, and then it causes that confusion of faith.
That's right, and we covered that today in Isaiah chapter 3. The show of their countenance doth witness against them, and it's not true that means a shameful face, because the very next line says they have no shame. They're Sodomites. The Sodomites don't have any shame.
Right.
So it's clearly a reference to the face of a mixed-race mongrel. That's what it means, okay? All right, now here we are. Here's the one I really want to address today, Colossians 2:14. And I understand, Bill, you have it on your screen there at biblos.com, which is a website I highly recommend to everybody, because you get multiple translations of particular verses all displayed on the same page. I'm going to first read the Moffat translation, Then I'm going to flip to the King James, which in my opinion is the worst of all these translations. First Baphomet, he forgave us all our trespasses. He canceled the regulations. Okay? He uses the word regulations here instead of handwriting. So the regulations is the subject of the sentence. The regulations that stood against us, all these obligations he set aside when he nailed them to his cross. Okay? So, according to Moffat, what he set aside and nailed to the cross were these obligations with their attendant regulations. Okay? Obligations and regulations. Verse 14 from the King James, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances which that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. So first, before we get into the multiple translations here, Pastor Greg, is there any indication to you from these two translations that I just quoted that the entire law of Moses was nailed to the cross?
No, anybody that could get that from reading that, even the King James.
Yes.
And like you said, it's one of the worst.
Yes.
You cannot get that the law was done away with from using the word ordinances.
Right.
Ordinance, law, judgments, commandments, statutes are all different.
Yes, yes. And then I would go further than that and even say, since the subject is the word handwriting, which is a singular case, not plural. Now listen carefully. The handwriting was against us. Not ordinances were against it. So this verse is not even addressing the specific ordinances. What it's addressing is what he says here in Moffat, regulations. And I would suggest it's actually even more specific than that. The charges that are levied against the guilty party. That's what this handwriting, it's written down on a piece of paper, the sins, the list of sins of Israel. Has nothing to do, it's not addressing the law of Moses in any way, shape, or form. Now, Bill, you know, if you want to comment first before you get into that multiple list of translations, I think that list of translations will demonstrate to people how poorly translated this King James Version is.
Well, I'd probably like to make my comments after the list of translations.
Okay, all right.
What I'll say is that I posted my own translation of this in preparation for tonight on the discussion page of my own website, and it's actually a JPEG picture, so you don't have to worry about the Greek fonts.
Okay.
It's the Greek and the English, my own English literal translation from my Paul translation next to it, and it's laid out so that you could, it's almost like an interlinear, but not quite, it's side by side. And I put that there for a reason, and I'll leave it there for a couple of weeks. But
okay.
I'm going to defend my own translation here, but I'm also going to explain it,
yes.
And I'd rather wait until we
right,
go
okay.
to these other translations.
Yeah, well, give us some of the ones you have on your screen.
Okay, the International Standard Version. Having erased the charges that were brought against us,
okay, charges.
Along with their
right.
obligations that were hostile to us,
okay.
He took those charges away when he nailed them to the cross.
Okay, so charges is the operative word in that translation. Okay.
Yes, that's a little liberal.
Okay.
The New American Standard Bible, having canceled out the certificate of debt
mm-hmm.
consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us,
mm-hmm.
he has taken it out of the way, nailing it to the cross.
Now this hostility is not to be, you know, it's like we discussed about the word evil last night. It's, you know, it's definitely hostile to us, but it's our own fault that it's hostile to us. Isn't that what we're being told?
Well, yeah, but the hostile, it's the word hupenantios means opposition.
Okay.
It means to face.
Mm-hmm.
It means to face against, more or less.
Right. Okay.
It means to oppose something.
Right. So when there are charges levied against you, those charges are in opposition to you. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. What's
now,
next?
Mm-hmm. The American Standard Version, having blotted out the bond written in ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, nailing it to the cross.
Mm-hmm.
The Duarenes.
Mm-hmm.
Blotting out the handwriting of the decree that was against us. Now, decree, I'm going to say that's an excellent translation of that word.
Okay.
which was contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, fastening it to the cross.
Okay, so far we have charge, decree. What else? We have, you know, all of these things, and there was a bond or writ. Okay.
Yes.
All of these translations specify the charges, which are usually handed down in writing.
Well, none of them say the law.
That's right. That's right. Which
is important.
Exactly.
Because the word nomos is not here, and I'll explain the word that's here after we do this.
Okay. So far, so good. You know what we're seeing here is that the antinomian version of the translation interpretation of this verse is far-fetched. Okay, please continue.
All right, the Weymouth New Testament also calls it a bond.
Okay.
The bond with its requirements, which was enforced against us and was hostile to us, he canceled and cleared it out of the way, nailing it to his cross.
Okay.
Most of the other translations have ordinances, which is probably the most common translation of the word dogma.
Right. Oh, okay. Dogma.
The actual Greek word is dogma.
Uh-huh.
And I would like, if anybody...
All right, so go ahead, because I think this has given our listeners the true flavor of what this verse is actually saying. And it's not in no way saying that the law of Moses was nailed to the cross. Okay? So now continue with your, you know...
If anybody wants to go to the discussion page on my website, they'll see the Greek... The first word, and my English is word for word, and this is very rare, in the exact same order that the Greek is here.
Okay. Right.
Okay, which is extremely
now,
rare.
Now, don't be doing the interlinear thing.
well, right, that's impossible, but this is one of those rare verses where my English is in the same order.
Okay, interesting.
And I try to leave it in the same order whenever I could when I translate, but that's practically impossible.
Right, right.
Exolipsis, having wiped out,
mm-hmm.
Okay? It means to wipe off.
Mm-hmm.
To kath hamon chirographon. Now, this is in the accusative case, chirographon.
Okay.
And so is hupenantion later, which means that they're part of the same idea.
Okay.
Okay? Now, chirographon is the handwriting.
Yes.
Okay? It's the handwriting against us is to kath hamon chirographon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next phrase is tois dogmasin, and that means in the ordinances. It's in the dative case,
okay.
Meaning in or with the object, which is in the dative case, which in this case is dogmas or ordinances, as it's commonly translated.
Yes, yes.
And dogmas would be an that one translation had dogmas would be an ex or decrees
yes.
would be an excellent translation here.
Okay.
Now.
Okay.
Ho ein hupenantion hamin is which were opposed to us.
Okay.
Now this hupenantion is in the accusative case just like chirographon is.
Mm-hmm.
So the handwriting opposed to us is all the same object.
Yes.
And that's what those cases indicate.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So in other words,
he is taken out of the way, nailing it to the cross.
So again, we have another reference to this handwritten decree. Or this list of charges, or as I like to prefer, I prefer the word indictment.
Right.
Which
but
would be
I,
a
I,
modern translation of the what's going on there.
I know I translated it ordinances when I did my Colossians translation back in 2002 or 2001 or whatever.
Yes.
Today I would probably leave it dogmas.
Okay.
And that's for this reason, because it's not the law which is being discussed here.
That's right.
Act dogma is a Greek word. It's translated decree several times in Daniel chapter 6,
mm-hmm.
where he's talking about the decrees of the king.
Yes.
And in fact, Daniel 6:8, it says, "Oh, now, O king, establish the decree." And a decree is an ordinance handed down by a man.
Right.
That's a dogma.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the law in the Old Testament handed down by God.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the word dogma does not appear in the Old Testament anywhere until the book of Esther.
Okay.
It's in Esther, it's in Daniel, it's in Ezekiel, and it's in the books of Maccabees, 3 and 4 Maccabees.
Yes, right.
Okay? It's in Luke 2:1 in the New Testament. And in Luke 2:1, it's talking about the decree of Caesar to go out and tax the whole world.
Okay, okay.
Whenever we see the word dogma, we're talking about the decrees of men.
Okay,
not
okay.
The law of Yahweh.
All right.
Not
right.
The law of God.
Okay.
And Paul qualifies this in the very next verse.
Okay, well, go ahead.
Okay?
Yes.
Where he says in verse 2:15, stripping the sovereignties and authorities which he exposed publicly, triumphing over them in it.
Uh-huh.
And then in verse 16, he goes on to say, therefore, no one must judge you in food and drink or in respect of new months or of the Sabbath.
Yes, yes.
Now, what is Paul talking about? Let's examine.
Yeah, okay, let me just quickly interrupt you here because I understand he's not talking about Yahweh's Sabbath.
Right.
He's talking about different.
Well, no, I don't even think he's talking about the day on which the Sabbath falls.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't even go there.
Okay.
What is Christ constantly reproached for, rebuked for by the Pharisees and the Sadducees all throughout the gospel?
Yeah.
Healing people for doing good on the Sabbath.
That's right.
Washing before you eat and drink. Mark chapter 7.
Yes.
Oh, your disciples, they didn't wash their hands before they ate.
You got to wash up to your elbows.
The new moon feast, what Christ did on the Sabbath, and how they washed their hands.
Exactly.
That's what Paul is talking about here.
Yes.
He's talking not about the laws of Yahweh. He's talking about the decrees, the traditions of the elders of the Pharisees.
That's right.
Who are always, always trying to rebuke Christ for these very things that Paul's talking about in conjunction with the ordinances, the dogmas, dogmas in the tradition of the elders that were added to the law by men, they're what Yahshua Christ stripped away because the rituals were done away with, and it's the rituals of Hebrew law that today the Catholic priests get all of their supposed authority from, and the Pharisees and Sadducees get all their authority from.
Absolutely.
They were done away with in Daniel chapter 9.
Mm-hmm.
So then the ordinances that were nailed to the cross, everything they added to that is done when they were done.
Yes. Okay.
So the Pharisees and Sadducees have no more sovereignty. They have no more authority.
Right, right. Yes. So, Pastor Greg, now you mentioned earlier that these Judeo-Christian churches have substituted these traditions of men for the law of God. Is there any way of reading this chapter so far, our discussion up to this point, that suggests that the law of Yahweh, that Paul is criticizing the law of Yahweh rather than these non-scriptural ordinances?
Not at all. I mean, the word law is never even mentioned here.
That's right.
He's talking about something completely different.
Okay. Yeah, and I think was earlier he did the traditions of men. That was mentioned earlier in this chapter, wasn't it?
Yes.
He does. Moffat doesn't use that expression in his translation. So there's at least two references here to the traditions of men, which cannot be equated with the law of Yahweh. Cannot be equated.
Exactly. That's the entire context of the chapter.
Yes.
You know, it's like today. If you drink a can of beer, you don't pay your tithe and you don't come to church. You know, that's as much law as they've got.
That's right.
And they're all the traditions of men.
And don't forget the football game at 1:00.
And get baptized.
Baptized with a pizza. Okay. So, and then, Bill, why don't you continue? Have you got your translation there in front of you?
Well, yeah, my translation, I actually just gave it. It's very little. It's having wiped out the handwriting against us in the ordinances or dogmas,
mm-hmm.
which were opposed to us.
Yeah, actually, I was referring to verse 17. Just continue from where you left off.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so let me just pick up with the Moffat at verse 16. I'll let you pick up with verse 17. So let no one take you to task on questions of eating and drinking or in connection with observance of festivals or new moons or Sabbaths. Now, here, This verse, the anti-Paulians jump on this verse. You know, they jump all over this verse because here Paul is saying, oh, we don't have, we shouldn't be concerned about the Sabbaths and feast days, et cetera, et cetera. Forget all that stuff. That's how they interpret this, and they think he's talking about the law of Yahweh.
Well, right, and that's not what Paul's talking about. And let me tell you what I think Paul's talking about. He's talking about doing good works on the Sabbath, which the Pharisees and the Sadducees always tried to
criticize. Yes.
All right, and let me tell you, the Dead Sea Scrolls, all right, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I can cite this, and I do cite it in my paper, William Fink Against the Paul Bashers, which is on my website. The Dead Sea Scrolls have an explicit line in there saying that if a man or a sheep or an ox falls into a pit on a Sabbath, you are not to take it out.
Mm-hmm.
And people look at the New Testament accounts and they think they're a little wild. Well, the Dead Sea Scroll spells that right out.
Right.
And Yahshua Christ is saying just the opposite.
Yes.
The Sabbath is a day of rest, and we're not to do our menial labor and the tasks that we do the other 6 days of the week.
Right.
We should go out and sow our fields and things like that. But we should help each other out and do good for each other.
Absolutely.
And the Pharisees and the Sadducees would prevent that.
Well, it was interesting. There was a Jew, possibly even a rabbi, that was in our chat room when we first started discussing, I think it was, what was the last book we read? Hebrews. And he said something to me, and we discussed the Sabbath and the fact that it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And then this guy was saying in the chat room, no, it's not. And I said, well, why not? Give me, what's your evidence?
It's a Judaizer.
That's right, exactly. And just let me finish the thought here. I asked him, what's your evidence that the Old Testament teaches that it's unlawful to do good on the Sabbath? And then he referred back to Genesis 1:27. God rested. Well, that doesn't say anything about doing good or evil on the Sabbath. All it says is that God rested. Okay?
Right.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with the law.
Let me add a couple more things about verse 16 here.
Okay.
First, my own Sabbath philosophy is that I celebrate a Saturday Sabbath. I don't work on Saturdays, and I read, and
mm-hmm.
I do my email and things like that.
Okay.
But I do that trying to help people. I mean,
sure.
Otherwise I'm not going to have the chance to email them, and that's it.
Right.
But aside from that, if I'm at your house and you say, Bill, I take my Sabbath on Sundays, I'm not going to jump all over you for that.
Yeah.
I'm in your house, I'm going to take a Sunday Sabbath.
Right.
If I go to Ken's house and he does the Saturday Sabbath, that's fine with me. I'm going to do the Saturday Sabbath.
Yeah.
I'm in this man's house.
Right.
My brother, I'm not going to hate on him because he wants to do a Saturday Sabbath or a Sunday Sabbath. It doesn't matter to me.
Right, right.
Do your Sabbath on the seventh day, and
mm-hmm.
if you just happen to believe it's Sunday, I'm not going to get on you about it.
Right, and there's all this conflict about the actual calendar, when is the real first day and when is the real seventh day, and that's still up for grabs. There's a lot of debate even within Christian identity about that. Pastor Greg, I understand you do a Saturday Sabbath too, right?
Yes, I do Saturday, but I tell people all the time, if you believe it's Tuesday, keep Tuesday. Because
right.
Yahweh said he winks at our ignorance. I may be ignorant and keep a Saturday.
I do the Saturday Sabbath, but Ken has the healthy attitude.
Yes. Yeah.
No doubt.
And if we're unsure about the letter of the law, then keep the spirit of the law. How can Yahweh criticize you for that?
Right.
Well, he won't.
That's right.
We don't have any guarantee that we have the same calendar. And I know there are people that insist that we do, but we don't. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, and the fact is, even in the days of Jesus Christ, there were no named days of the week. There was no Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Absolutely.
And
right.
So,
that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
Now, as far as this food and drink thing is concerned,
okay,
this is not a license to eat pork.
Right.
Because the word is food, and the Greek word more or less means food, and pork, to Paul, is not food.
Okay, right.
And I go into this at length in that same paper, William Fink versus the Paul Bashers.
Right.
I hate to keep advertising my own writing, but it's free.
Yes.
Food is food, and pork, to Paul, is not food. When Paul says food, he means food.
Yes,
and,
right.
And Chinese people eat roaches. I'm not going to eat roaches. They're not food.
Chocolate-covered ants?
Right. That's not food.
Right, right.
Well, it's like I've had people accuse me because you're supposed to sit down and eat and not ask anything.
Oh.
Just eat whatever's set in front of you. I said, no, that's not what that's talking about.
Right.
It's talking about if I come to a brother's house, I know that he's not going to serve me something that's got something unclean in it.
Right, right.
And so, you know, I would sit down and eat with no conscience, but now if he said that it's been sacrificed to
Baal, yes,
then I push it away and don't eat it.
Uh-huh.
That's all that's talking about. That ain't assuming you can eat pork.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and the Christians in those days didn't eat pork.
I'd like to spend a minute on that, if you don't mind.
Uh-huh, good.
Sure. Another minute.
Sure.
Greeks, a lot of Greeks, and it's evident in Strabo,
there were
many temples of Aphrodite and other gods and goddesses in the Greek world that did not accept swine for sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And Strabo states that explicitly of the temples of Aphrodite, which is the temple of Diana.
Right.
Now,
right.
At Ephesus.
Right.
Now, so many Greeks, the Greek world was divided. Herodotus called pork unclean.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Strabo also called pork unclean. If not, if it wasn't Strabo, it was definitely Diodorus Siculus. It was
right.
One or the other. And there was much division in the Greek world over whether or not pork should be eaten.
Right.
The Romans had no qualms about eating anything.
Right, right.
Okay, that's all over their artwork and their literature.
Right.
Now, they were straight heathens.
Right,
but
right.
A lot of the Greeks did not eat pork.
Yes.
And Ken's exactly right. The context in Corinthians, where Paul's talking about food sacrificed to idols,
mm-hmm.
Well, in the ancient Greek and Roman cities, the meat markets were attached to the temples.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and the sacrifices of the temples would be split up and sold at the meat market.
Right, right.
So if I came over your house to eat and you had meat, well, unless you had your own flock of sheep in the yard,
right.
Chances are you got your meat from one of those temples,
right,
and
right.
It had been sacrificed to an idol.
Yeah, and Paul also says, well, the mere fact that it has been, let's say, dedicated to an idol, that does not make the meat unclean either. Because those idols don't exist.
And that's exactly what Paul's trying to say.
Right.
When you go to a friend's house or somebody's house to eat,
yes.
you don't ask where the meat came from.
Right, as long as it's not pork.
It's not pork either.
That's right. It's not pork. Yes, yes. And so since these idols don't really exist, I mean, it exists in the minds of the idol worshipers, but that has not made the meat impure. So
that's exactly what Paul's saying.
So don't raise a big stink about it, you know. While why antagonize people you're trying to convert to Christianity by telling them, "Oh, you shouldn't eat stuff dedicated to idols, you idiots." You know,
it's like me and my wife were invited over to sister-in-law's house.
Okay.
Eat, and they were divorced, but anyway, we went to, and I mean everybody in the her family knows that we don't eat pork or anything unclean,
right.
but I don't know if she forgot or what, but anyway,
yes.
We got there, and here's she's got a big ham.
Oh, my goodness.
So they pass the food around, and we just pass the ham on by, so don't say anything.
Exactly.
But we take the carrots and the peas and so forth, you know, and say nothing.
Right.
But now, then she says, "Do you not eat pork?" And I say, "No, we don't eat it." And
mm-hmm.
and that's all.
Yeah.
You know. But now, if they want to push the issue,
right.
Well, why don't you eat pork?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I'll explain to them. But you don't have to be a jerk about it.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Well, that's the right thing, and that's the tactful thing to do because you're in the house of a brother or a sister, and that's
you heathen are serving
ways,
pork.
They're wrong.
Right. Yeah. So. The commandment is love thy brother.
Right,
and
that's first.
Yes, that's the first and foremost. And so, you know, you don't start criticizing them because, well, obviously they're doing wrong in the eyes of the Bible. But it's not one of those sins that's going to kill them immediately. they will get trichinosis eventually or something related, you know. And, you know, so you can talk about the health aspects of pork and then the fact that the Bible forbids it. And this is why we don't do it, you know. And if you know, most people will accept that and appreciate it.
Right.
Most people aren't going to give you a hard time about that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Now, let me read one here about pork while we're on the pork issue.
Okay.
I pulled this on some Judeo preachers. There's a bunch of them sitting there in this meeting I was in.
Okay.
Isaiah 66:15. For behold, Yahweh will come with fire and with his chariots like whirlwind to render his anger and fury and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword will Yahweh plead with all flesh, and the slain of Yahweh shall be many. For I know their works and their thoughts, and it shall come that I will gather all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. And I mean, you can keep reading, okay? And I asked these guys, I said, is this an end day prophecy? And they said, yes. I said, so it hasn't happened yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. I said, well, let me back up and read verse 17. I purposely skipped it.
Okay.
For they that sanctify themselves and purify themselves in the garden behind one tree in the midst, eating swine's flesh and the abomination and the mouse, shall be consumed together, saith Yahweh.
Right.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I said, now, wait a minute. You done said this in the end day prophecy. He said when he comes back with chariots of fire, the dead's going to be many, and those eating the swine's flesh and the abomination, all those things he said not to eat are abominations.
That's right.
He's going to consume them together.
That's right. That's right. Because when we're purified, if you got all that impurity in your body, it's going to hurt.
Right.
It's going to hurt big time. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, okay, so we're preaching not to eat pork, folks. And the rest of the Judeo-Christian world is saying, oh, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah. Put whatever you want to put on the table and just add, ask God to bless it. And I say, well, what about some roast skunk and possum gravy?
That's
nasty. I said, what about a rat?
Exactly.
Fast in to bless it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I said, it ain't no more nasty than that filthy worm meat.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and if you go to a Chinese restaurant, you don't know what it is you're eating.
Oh, yeah, it tastes like chicken.
Yeah, right.
But I can testify that when Chinese restaurants move into a neighborhood, all the cats disappear.
So the cats and dogs disappear.
I swear, I where I grew up, I've seen it all my life.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so Bill, why don't you continue with verse 17 and go to 17 and 18. I definitely want to quote Moffat's translation of 18 because it's just so elegant. So please go ahead.
All right. Well, from 17, talking about the food and drink and new month feast and the Sabbath, from 17 it says, which are a shadow of future things.
Okay.
Whereas the body is of the anointed, meaning Israel, the group.
Yes. And
let
here,
no
even,
one,
okay.
Verse 18, let no one find you unworthy of reward, being willing with humiliation even in the worship of the messengers.
Okay.
And Paul here is talking, and I could correlate this to, I think it's 1 Corinthians 10:20 or something like that, where he says that the things that the nations sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons.
Yes.
Which in the Greek cosmology, demons are spirit beings lower than Yahweh or God himself.
Sure, sure.
All right? And okay. Not to Yahweh.
Yes.
And that means that all of these false religions, the worship of Aphrodite and Athena and Apollo and Diana and whatever.
Hercules, yeah.
They were all instituted originally by the fallen angels.
Yes. Okay. Very
good. The
world's
false religions came from the rebels of Genesis chapters 3 and 6.
Yes.
And that's what Paul is telling us here, talking about the worship of the angels or the messengers, and in 1 Corinthians, where he talks about the sacrifice of things to demons.
Yes, yes. Okay, I'm going to ask Pastor Greg, what version have you got today?
I've got a King James I'm looking at today, but it's one I have in my suitcase, and I'm on the road. Of course, I told you earlier, I'm about 50 miles from you.
Well, let me continue here. Let me reread verse 18, Moffat's, and then I'll ask you to continue with the King James here. Verse 18 in the Moffat, let no one lay down rules for you as he pleases with regard to fasting and any cult of angels, presuming on his visions and inflated by his sensuous notions, instead of keeping in touch with the head under whom the entire body, supplied with joints and sinews and thus compacted, grows with growth divine. Okay? So, he's saying, don't listen to these rules and regulations made up by men. This is the third time he says this in this chapter.
Well, that's clearly the context of the chapter.
Yeah.
However, that translation, I find very little support for it. It's very liberal.
It's very elegant, though.
Yes, it sounds great, but it'd be even better if that's what the Greek said.
Right. Okay, Pastor Greg, why don't you take it from verse 18 to the rest of the way, and then, you know, Bill, you know, if you have any comments on these other verses, just go ahead, okay?
Okay, you want me reading that through the end?
Well, no,
okay.
Take it from 18 because I want to hear the King James Version, too.
Okay, let no man beguile you in your reward in a voluntary humility and worshiping of angels, intruding into those things which he hath not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind.
Right, okay. Okay, please continue.
And not holding the head from which all the body by joints and bands, having nourishment, ministered and knit together, increaseth with in the increase of God.
So we're supposed to consider ourselves the body of Christ, in other words, okay? We are with sinews, muscles, nerves, etc. Okay, yeah, please continue, verse 20.
Wherefore, if you be dead with Messiah from the rudiments of the world, why, as though living in the world, are you subject to ordinances? Touch not, taste not, handle not, which all are to perish with the using, after the commandments and doctrines of men.
All right, there's a fourth reference to the commandments of men here, okay?
Yeah. Which things have indeed. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay, Bill, you had a comment there?
Well, yeah, the ordinances here again is dogmas, and Paul reinforces our interpretation of 14 by talking about the commandments and instructions of men.
Right.
A dogma is a decree by a man, and it's never used of the decrees of Yahweh God or of the law in the Old Testament.
Yeah, and even though we don't want to touch pork, it's not talking about Yahweh's ordinances. It's as you just said. It's talking about the commandments of men. And even though the Jews say they don't eat pork, you know, the fact is they sin all the time in various other ways, and they really don't.
And they eat pork too.
That's right.
I've seen plenty of Jews eat pork.
I know.
Yes, I have seen Jews that ate pork.
Yeah.
And I've seen Muslims that were Christian on the day that the prison served pork.
Oh, yeah, they became Christians. They become Christians on that day.
They hide that goofy quick.
Right.
If they got pork ribs.
Yes, fabulous, absolutely fabulous.
Well, all maybe right. They asked God to bless it, and maybe their God did bless it.
Yes, that's the God of swine.
Yeah.
Okay, please continue.
Which things have indeed a shoe of wisdom in will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, not in any honor to the satisfying of the flesh.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Was that verse 22 or did you?
23.
That's
23.
Okay. So, Bill, why don't you read your translation of 22 and 23? Because I know you have issues with the King James here as well.
Oh, definitely. But let me preface that by saying that verse 23 is an extremely difficult verse to translate and get the sense of.
Okay.
And I've never been happy with my own translation.
Okay.
My translation is aimed at being very literal, and I really try not to take any liberties
with
any of the words by interpreting them.
Right.
Now, sometimes it's impossible to do that.
Okay.
However,
well,
sometimes it just doesn't read very well. And this is one of those times.
Well, let me read the Moffat translation. Again, it's very elegant. This is like from halfway of 22. These rules are determined by human precepts and tenets. They get the name of wisdom for their self-imposed devotions, their fasting, their rigorous discipline of the body, but they are of no value. They simply pamper the flesh. So in other words, you know, Paul is criticizing, again, the traditions of men.
Right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Moffat's translation is very elegant, and I believe that I could probably write very elegantly like that, but a lot of those words aren't, you know, it's an interpretation paraphrase more than it is a translation.
Okay.
And that's fair if you feel that you are conveying the sense of the meaning properly.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, many of the secular Greek books that I've read, all the Greek poets and Strabo and Homer and Herodotus, and they're all like that. I mean, when scholars sit down and do the translations, they quite often translate with that same method.
Yes.
But with the Bible, to me, it's important that I don't want to be caught adding anything to anything.
Yes, yes. Okay.
It's important to get, a literal translation and let the reader decide what things mean.
Yes. Okay, so let's hear your translation of verse 23.
Reading from 22, after it says one should not hold nor taste, it says things which are all for corruption in their misuse.
Okay.
Those things that you're not supposed to touch and things like that.
Right.
According to the commands and instructions of men. In other words, it's men and not Yahweh who told you, don't touch this, don't taste that, don't do this.
Right.
And Yahshua Christ told the Jews again and again, the Jews meaning the Pharisees, the unbelieving Pharisees and Sadducees, that they'll strain out a gnat.
Exactly.
Because a gnat is unclean.
And this
swallow a camel.
Right. And this is another verse that the Paul bashers jump on because they assume that he's talking about the rules against eating pork and such.
Well, no, he's not. He's talking about the traditions of the elders and
exactly.
all the things that they added to the law,
right.
which made it so much more stringent and legalistic
yes.
than it was meant to be.
That's right.
Now, verse 23,
okay.
things which are a statement indeed, holding wisdom in submissive worship and humiliation and disregard of the body,
okay.
not in any esteem for satisfaction of the flesh.
Okay.
In other words, all of these things, even though they're very strict rules, they don't really satisfy the body.
Right, right. And since they're not part of Yahweh's law, they'll be ineffectual.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that's what Paul's saying.
Yeah, okay. Well, I hope the Paul bashers are listening to tonight's show because I think we have exposed at least four or five of the myths that the pro-Paul, I shouldn't even call him pro-Paul, that the universalists, the universalizers, have taken and twisted Paul's words in such a drastic fashion that it's become a pretzel, and you cannot make sense from the Judeo-Christian interpretation of the Bible, of this chapter, because I think we have demonstrated that it just does not say anything like what they assume it says.
Absolutely, but they never read the whole chapter.
That's right.
They never read a whole book. They read half of a verse here
yes.
and half of a verse there. They put them together and they come up with the doctrine.
Right, right. And
all spiritualized.
Right. And it's a combination of spiritualizing, taking verses out of context.
That's a good analogy, Ken.
Yeah. Overgeneralizing and then just plain lying.
Yeah, and that's what I've called it for years. People say, "Well, I spiritualize that." I say, "Well, that's what I call a spiritual lie."
Yes,
absolutely. That's a good analogy.
So this is what the Bible, true Bible scholarship, is up against. We've got all these people; they have their own agenda, and typically all these different denominations. They all say that only our denomination has the truth. And, of course, we're doing the same thing. But none of these other denominations will go into the depth of detail that we are discussing these verses in today. And I would simply suggest, to all of our listeners, please let more people know about what we're doing on these shows, because no one goes to the depths of discussion and revelation of what these scriptures are really saying, because the Judeo-Christian world is totally deluded and is full of liars who call themselves priests. So is the Jewish world. They're all liars.
That's a matter of prophecy. Ephraim will learn doctrine line upon line. It
yes.
has to happen sooner or later.
Exactly. So if you take chapter 2, verse 14, completely out of context, and if you take those verses about, eating meat dedicated to idols out of context, they take all these verses out of context and they create a completely different Bible.
And that's why the Paul bashers bash Paul.
Right.
Because they believe the Judeo-Christian interpretation.
That's right. So, you know, if you understand, typically, and this is kind of what gets at my craw about the Paul bashers, is they should know better. They should know that these universalizers are liars, and that they should suspect, well, maybe they twisted Paul's words at least here and there. No, but they blame Paul.
Well, I hate to demean anybody, but I've worked my life in several vocations over a long period of time.
Right.
And I've learned that most men are lazy and take the easy way out.
Right, okay.
I found this in law enforcement. I found this in computer programming.
Uh-huh.
It's the way it is. It's a lot easier being a computer programmer to copy and paste than it is to actually write code.
That's right.
And it's true here in religion also.
Right.
It's easier for men to accept somebody else's interpretation of something and make a decision based upon it than to actually study the matter for themselves.
Yeah, and then go to the further step of investigating the original Greek and Hebrew meanings of these words. And even the further step, as you've been able to do, is translate whole passages to understand what, some horrible translations have been made. And so, so when we talk about Paul and trying to blame Paul for all these errors, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about errors. Now, these errors have come not through Paul, but through, first of all, the Masoretes, who, influenced the Old Testament.
And the New, the Masoretes had a great deal. The Alexandrian Jews had a great deal of influence over Jerome.
Okay.
When he did the Vulgate.
All right.
And Jerome's Vulgate, even though the reformers were breakaways from Catholicism, Jerome's Vulgate had a great deal of influence on the reformers when they translated their Bibles.
Yes. Right. So just about every book, and I think Dr. Wesley Swift said the King James translators had at least 20 Jewish advisors. when the translators were in doubt, they would consult these Jewish advisors, which is the last thing they should have done. So what we've got here in the King James Version is way more interpretation. And obviously, so most of it's good. The vast majority of it is good. But when we come to these problem passages, where the Bible appears to contradict itself, and especially where Paul seems to be saying the opposite of what Jesus Christ is saying. And in this context, I agree with the Paul bashers. Yeah, there are many instances where it seems that Paul is directly denying the words of Jesus Christ, but those aren't Paul's words.
Right.
They're somebody else's words.
Right. Well, everything came off the Masoretic text anyway. The Edomites had control of that. They took those scrolls and destroyed them and created the Masoretic text.
Yes.
Well, why did they destroy them? Because they had changed things, added things, taken things away.
Mm-hmm.
So, even the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were found in, 1946?
Yeah, somewhere.
And they were only released when?
Right.
And then...
It's suppressed, yes.
The ones I've seen, they're written in Babylonian Hebrew, except his name is written in Paleo-Hebrew.
Right.
Oh, well, let's see. Who would have done something like that?
Right.
Yes, that's quite often in the Dead Sea Scrolls. I could vouch for that.
Right. And also even in the Septuagint, even though the Septuagint was written in left to right in Greek, the name of Yahweh in many instances was retained right to left in Paleo-Hebrew.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize that, and especially those even within identity who say, well, Yahweh, the name of Yahweh was not used by the Israelites, it was Canaanite users. No. Even in the Septuagint, there's I've seen photographic copies of the Septuagint scrolls, fragments, which retain the name of Yahweh in Paleo-Hebrew. Simply no doubt about it.
My feelings are very mixed, and maybe that's because I am a translator of the New Testament, and I do read Greek, and I understand how translations are made.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, I scorned the Masoretic text and the Jews.
Yes.
But the Masoretic text and the Dead Sea Scrolls are very important.
Oh, yes.
Because when translations are made, by necessity, interpretations are made.
Right.
Of what men at the time believed that a text reads.
Yes.
And while the Septuagint is clearly superior over the Masoretic text in all the historical books,
mm-hmm.
okay, and a lot of the apocryphal books that are valid belong and are in the Septuagint. However, a lot of the prophecies, the way they read in the Septuagint is not as clear as the way they read in the Masoretic text. And I'm talking about prophecies
okay.
that are clearly defined, that are in our past today.
Right.
Such as Daniel's 70-week prophecy in chapter 9.
Okay.
The prophecy in Daniel chapter 2 of the four beasts. The prophecy in Daniel chapter 7, which goes over those same
mm-hmm.
empires and the time of Justinian and all that. The,
right.
the way I interpret it, but I'm not the only person who interprets it in this method. It's also
sure.
Clifton Emmaheiser and Bertrand Comparet and
right.
and a lot of other early identity, you know, the great names in identity.
Right.
And in the Septuagint, they're just not as clear cut. And sometimes wrong interpretations were made of words. And I'm not saying that
yeah.
that possibly the original text was invalid, but I'm saying that things got lost in the interpretation.
Well, as you're saying that, what's occurring to me is that Ptolemy, I believe it was Ptolemy Philadelphus, who conscripted the 70 scribes from the house of Judah.
Yeah, it may have been Ptolemy Lagi, who was his father or grandfather, but
okay.
that's not important.
Yeah, and so it could be that these gentlemen, these 70 Judahite scribes, not Jewish scribes, these were Judahites, not Jews, that the you know that perhaps and Greek, and in those days there was still a great conflict between the Hellenizers and those who tried to maintain the law of Moses in those days.
Oh,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, and so the people who were willing and able to make the translation from the Hebrew into the Greek, you know, some of them could have been Hellenizers. Some of them, you know, said, well, I don't really want to do this, but it's a good job, you know. And so there may have been several conflicts among many of these scribes who were hired to do this.
Right. And I would agree in the end that the Septuagint is very important, and in a lot of ways it's very superior to the Masoretic text, but I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Okay, okay.
I wouldn't throw the Masoretic text away.
Right.
It's a valuable resource, and we need it.
Yes.
And the same is true of Josephus.
Right.
And the same is true of the Samaritan Pentateuch.
Right.
The same is true of the Dead Sea Scrolls. We need to study
yes.
all of the sources and measure all of the sources.
Yes. Yes.
And we always have to look, because the Old Testament text is so corrupt, the lens that we should examine them through
mm-hmm.
always has to be the New Testament.
Yes. Yes.
Because those people were a lot closer, aside from the fact that Yahshua Christ and
yes.
his divinity, but those people, the writers of the New Testament, were a lot closer to the Old Testament
yes.
than we are today, 2,000 years later.
Absolutely. But it's my understanding, and perhaps you know both you and Pastor Greg can comment, that the Septuagint is actually the preferred text of the early Christians, and possibly even of Yahshua, Messiah, and the 12 apostles. That because my understanding is that when they quote the Old Testament, it more closely agrees with the Septuagint than it does with the Masoretic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without a doubt, that's true. I mean, there are places all throughout the Gospels where the Septuagint Greek and the New Testament Greek in manuscripts dug up the date to the 2nd century and the 3rd century where the Greek is identical except for maybe a letter here and there.
Uh-huh, okay.
A letter in a sentence.
Yes.
Where certain Greek words, the ending letters were often left off.
Right, right.
And that might confuse a neophyte, but that's the way it was.
Yes, and it is.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
So basically you could say they were exact.
Mm-hmm.
And certain diphthongs, like the EI diphthong, was often written just as an E.
Okay.
And the I was dismissed. And that happens often in Greek, even from one end of Paul's epistles to the other, with the same word.
Yes, yes.
It, the quotes of the New Testament, a great percentage of, 60, 70% of them, are extremely similar to the Septuagint, and a very high percentage, not quite that high, but is almost exact to the Septuagint.
Yes.
There is no doubt that the Septuagint was not, and Paul's language itself, there's no doubt the Septuagint was not the major influence on their lives as far as scriptural authority.
Okay.
But there is a percentage of quotes that more closely resemble the Masoretic text.
Okay, all right.
And I believe that's accounted for because if you read Josephus, Josephus has a lot of differences from the Masoretic text.
Okay.
And it's clear to me that Josephus had a better Hebrew manuscript than what the Masoretic text affords
today.
That's
quite possible, yes, yes. And it would certainly have been available to him, and it would have been an uncorrupted text because the Masoretes didn't start corrupting the text until after the death of Christ.
Right, and it says a lot for the language, and I believe that I could prove through demonstration that every book of the New Testament was originally written in Greek, not in Aramaic.
All right,
and the influence of the Septuagint over the New Testament also clearly demonstrates that.
Okay.
There's very little Aramaic influence in the New Testament.
Yes, okay.
There's a couple of quotations that are closer to the Aramaic Targums than they are to the Septuagint, but they're very few. The other way, it's abundant.
Right, right. Okay, Pastor Greg, you had a comment there?
Oh, I was going to say, so what you fellows are saying when it says study to show yourself approved, you're not just restricting yourself just to the King James Bible.
Right.
Right, and that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, yeah, because even though I know some King James-only people and they try to justify it, but the fact is, as you mentioned, Pastor Greg, the Masoretes cut out whole portions of the Old Testament and just threw them away.
Yes.
And that's why the Septuagint, virtually every book of the Septuagint, which is strictly Old Testament, is longer in the Septuagint than it is in the Masoretic text. Because
and
they just kept throwing stuff out.
There are several important messianic prophecies that most people don't know they exist because they're only in the Septuagint.
Right, and the Apocrypha are in the Septuagint.
And right, and the Apocrypha, I'm very divided on. The books of the Maccabees, 1 and 2 Maccabees, are valid historical books that belong in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there are things in 1 and 2 Maccabees that very much support our identity version of the Bible in history that I think there's a reason why they were taken out.
Right, right.
The story of Judith, I'm not sure about the story of Judith.
Okay.
I don't think Esther belongs in the Bible at all, and that would go to the editions of Esther in the Apocrypha.
Okay, okay.
The wisdom books in the Apocrypha are very important. The Maccabees books are very important.
Oh, they're definitely.
Now, the story of Susanna, I believe, is a legitimate story that should probably preface our current books of Daniel.
Yeah, right.
So the Apocrypha is very important. Tobit's an important story.
Yeah.
And Tobit's an important cultural story, whether or not one wants to accept it as canonical.
Yeah. And Tobit.
And another thing that belongs in the Bible is 1 Enoch. It's heavily quoted by Jude. It's quoted by Peter. And it's alluded to and quoted in the Gospels and in Paul at least 50 times.
Right, right.
And 1 Enoch, I'm not so certain. I doubt if the Enoch as we know it today, the 1 Enoch, because it's actually 5 or 6 books appended.
Okay.
But the core of 1 Enoch belongs in the Bible.
Right. Well, the crux of the matter is all these documents we're talking about, in the vast majority of cases, they support each other. They support each other magnificently in verifying each other. And that's generally true of the Greek texts that are available to us that we call the New Testament. My understanding is that there's very little disagreement among these texts, okay? So that when we include Josephus, when we include Maccabees 1 and 2, Tobit, Enoch, et cetera, they all tell our Israelite history. And having read most of this stuff, there's very little of it that conflicts with any other book. There is very little that conflicts, So I see all this as Israelite literature, and we should consider it as such. And if the Jews reject a book such as Susanna or Tobit, which they reject, then they have a reason for rejecting it. Well, for one thing, the book of Tobit, Tobit counsels his son to not marry outside of his race.
Oh, yeah, Tobit's an important book. I'm not saying it's not an important book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not sure it's entirely historical.
Okay, okay.
I like to, you know, I use my first measure of the veracity of an Old Testament book, I'm sorry, is the gospel accounts in the New Testament.
Okay.
If a book's not quoted or cited or something from it is borrowed or used, then that has to cast a shadow on it.
Okay.
And that's the first, especially Paul in Hebrews, where he goes into the Old Testament and lists all the heroes of the Old Testament, and there are some that are missing that's awfully precarious.
Yes, yes. Okay. All right. Well, I think we've done tremendous justice to Colossians chapter 2, and I'm looking forward to going into, you know, the rest of this book, which is what, the 5 or 6 chapters. It's not a very long book.
There's two more chapters.
So it's only 4 chapters as I'm turning the page here, and so looking forward to completing this book. And I understand, Bill, you want to go into Romans in the future. Because as I glean through Romans, there are very, very clear, he definitely preaches that we should keep the law. And as I understand it, and I think one of the main themes that's coming through this whole series that we've been discussing is the fact that these letters, these epistles, were written to Israelites. And not to the entire planet.
Absolutely, and Paul just clearly explains that here in Colossians chapter 2, like he did in Colossians chapter 1.
Yeah, okay. And Pastor Greg, any further thoughts? Because we only have a few minutes left.
No, I'll be glad to get into chapter 3. I like what it just starts right off talking about here.
Okay, all right.
Sitting there reading it.
Yeah, okay. All right, so any further thoughts from you, Bill? And then, you know, because I'll just quickly announce that you and I are going to be doing a show on the Phoenicians and demonstrating that they are, in fact, Israelites.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and that the Israelites were not hook-nosed kikes. They're
one
not
of my favorite
Jews.
Topics.
Yeah, and that the Israelites and the Aryans are the same people. They're not a different people, as the Jews would have us believe, and so we're going to go.
Well, that's why we have the lie that the Phoenicians are Canaanites.
Right.
Mask Jewish identity.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay, I have one question. Pastor Eli, why were they taken out? I assume the question is, why were the Apocrypha taken out? And my opinion is that because this happened, this did not happen until the 1700s. The 1700s and early 1800s. I believe it's Rothschild influence that had the Apocrypha taken out of the Bible. I know in one case, in the case of America, when the Bibles were being mass-produced by printers here in America, it had become fashionable to take them out, simply to get them out faster. Okay, that's one account that I heard. But also, it doesn't make any sense to me to take them out, because the original King James Version included the Apocrypha. So we have to ask the question, who is responsible for removing them? And I know the Jews don't like to refer to the Apocrypha. And so that gives you a good idea, a good clue as to who's responsible for it. Okay?
If you read Maccabees, you know why they took them out.
That's right.
Maccabees alone.
Yeah.
Them guys, they wasn't as lenient as we are.
Yeah, they kicked ass.
That's right.
they kicked Canaanite ass, and they kicked Hellenized ass, and they kicked Roman ass too. You know,
yeah.
The problem is that they kicked ass, and then they subdued and folded in the people who they beat up on.
Right.
And that's what gave us all the problems we have today.
Right.
And we still do that same thing today.
Yes.
We go to war in Vietnam, and what happens?
And
10 years later, there's 300,000 Vietnamese in the hills of California.
Yeah, no. Didn't the Rothschilds send us into Vietnam?
Well, of course
yeah.
They did. They've what? Always been behind it.
Yes, yes.
Stalin and who was it? Planned this Vietnam War 10-12 years before it ever happened.
Yeah, so they kill us by setting us into the war theater, And then they kill us by race mixing on top of it.
Right.
Yeah, well, the thief came but to steal and to kill. He came to steal our inheritance and to kill off our race. That's,
yes,
that's what they're doing right now in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
They're killing off the cream of the crop.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and the story goes that under Napoleon, the average height of the French man dropped by nearly a foot. Because,
right, because they brought Moors in to replace France.
Right, the cream of the white crop was all killed off thanks to Napoleon, and then you know, all these southern non-whites were brought in. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And then they're still doing it to us today, and so our people have to realize that this is a consciously organized plot. It's a campaign of genocide against our people. Our people have to understand this. Again, it goes back to Genesis 3:15. Where this plot was announced, and there's a conspiracy against us, and we have to understand that this conspiracy has always been organized by the seed of Cain, otherwise
right,
known as the Jews today.
Right. Yeah, did you all see Chuck Norris? Everybody knows him, I guess, TV actor.
Right.
He's calling for revolution.
Really?
And he said that he's thinking about running for president of Texas, because Texas never was ratified as a state.
Right. neither was the 16th Amendment.
Right, right. So, hey, let's get this ball rolling.
Yeah,
They talk about California now got a tax revolt going on.
Yeah, right. Well, California's bankrupt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need a tax revolt in New York.
Right.
The taxes on this house I'm living in is like paying rent.
Exactly, exactly. So, Yahweh is pushing our people's backs against the wall.
Yeah.
Because we have failed to obey his law. And
I think this is coming down to the consummation of the ages Edomites had it made if they had just left it alone. But
right,
they're pushing this new world order, this one world monetary system, cashless society, and Yahweh said if you'd left it alone, you'd been fine, but you weren't. You were greedy, and it's going to bring it all to a head, and Joseph's going to be a fire,
right,
Jacob's going to be a flame, and Esau is going to be stubble, and there's going to be none
right
left of the house of Esau, Edom, thus saith Yahweh.
Yes. Well, what is the meaning of the name of Cain? Acquisition.
Right, greed.
Greed. They cannot help themselves.
Yeah.
They just cannot help themselves. They cannot be satisfied with just stealing from us and killing us. They have to be our Lord and Master, just as Lucifer, Azazel, Satan, whatever name you want to use, it wants to replace himself, put himself in the place of Yahweh.
But that was the inevitable result of the fall of Adam.
Right,
And we'll discuss that next Friday on Genesis 4:1.
And to that extent, it's our fault because we allow it to happen. As I have said before, when we disobey the law, Jews happen.
Well,
that's why the Jews flee from you when you identify them and when you tell them you know what they're about.
Exactly.
They flee.
They do.
I have much personal experience with that.
Yes, yes. Okay. All right. Thank you both, gentlemen, for being with me tonight. This is I'm loving this. I'm loving this tremendously. The scriptures are just jumping out at us in a brand new, like they're saying things like they've never said before. And it's just because we are trying to understand and being true to the word of Yahweh. And
right,
none
Yahweh
of these other denominations are not even making half an attempt to understand these. They're simply satisfied to make up stories. And therefore, what they're doing is going to be destroyed. It's not being blessed by Yahweh, no matter how much they declare it is. They're liars and deceivers. They're antichrist. They are Pharisees. Okay?
Their own family will hunt them down the last days to kill them because of the lies that they've taught.
That's right. We are all going to live to see that. It's not going to be pretty, folks. Okay? All right. So thank you, Pastor Greg. Thank you, Bill Fink. Looking forward to doing tomorrow's show on the Phoenicians and Israelites. And for tonight's show, Yahweh bless everybody. Please tune again tomorrow. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello, yeah.
Praise Yahweh.
Good night.
Good night.